person has become proud of himself for having fallen into a hole and gotten out of it. The neighbors would say there's the person who got in the hole and got out of it. You realize this is any sort of trouble. Okay, a slightly more complicated curve, more beautiful curve too, is boy gets girl, boy loses girl. And this is, it doesn't have to be girl. A person gets something he likes a whole lot, loses it, gets it back.
Utterly average person on a day like any other day.
All right, now I'm going to graph. I'm really going to have to project in a theater this size, and do not worry about it. I'm perfectly capable of it. Because I am going to graph the most popular story in our civilization, and you can sell it again and again and again, and people will love it and love it and love it and will never stop loving it. It starts at the very bottom. There's a very unhappy girl whose mother has died.
Her father has been married. Her father is remarried. Going to be a big party at the prince's house. She can't go. She's hurting. She can't go. Her new mother or stepmother is a battle axe in me. That really rotten kid she's got, too. Okay. Property accumulation. Suppose the party has a swell time, right? Dances with the prince. Boring, boring, boring. This is a radical change in direction. Okay, she doesn't drop down as low as she was at the beginning because she's had a party and she's had a swell time. So she poops around at this level and the shoe fits. Let me show you something very interesting. Every creation myth starts this way. God gave us the sun, God gave us the moon, God gave us the corn, God gave us the salmon. Whatever, anybody, creation myth. We are the only people who have God take it all away again. This is the Old Testament up to here, and this is the Christian hope for resurrection. And I believe that that is the bone-deep reason that Cinderella will always be a popular story. I believe that. There's this man who has the worst job in Prague. Young man, no chance of promotion. He's underpaid. Hours are terrible. He has very disagreeable relatives. There's no chance he will ever know love in this life. Has no way to court anybody. Has no friends. He wakes up one morning. He has turned into a cockroach.
Now then, when I first started playing with this thing, I thought it was a parlor trick and that I was just a buffoon. And I used to myself anticipate what the objections to this scheme might be, that no great literary work of art could be graphed in this manner, and I myself used to say so. I would say you cannot graph Hamlet. But just a month ago, I started playing with this again, and I said, all right, by God, I'm going to try and graph Hamlet. And I'm going to surprise you because I've made an important discovery. Okay, where does Hamlet start? He starts on the same level as Cinderella for almost the same reasons. It's the death of a parent. When he sees his father's ghost, is that good fortune or ill fortune? You can't tell. When he drives Ophelia away, is that good fortune or ill fortune? You can't tell. When he kills Polonius behind the drapes, is that good fortune or ill fortune? You can't tell. I'm telling you this seriously. When Hamlet himself dies, is this good fortune or ill fortune? Exactly as dumb as an American Indian. Now then, this is our masterpiece. I think few people would argue with that. It's our greatest literary work. We love it. We recognize it as such. And I think that all this rise and fall, all those certainties about knowing what is good and bad, are pretensions. I think we pretend to recognize what is good and what is bad. Think of a child going to the circus. As a child is demanded of the child that the child love this. I'm persuaded every kid hated the circus as much as I did. Anyway, I think we are much relieved to have the truth told about life here as we perceive it, that we can't tell what is good and what is bad. And that's what Shakespeare says in Hamlet of himself. I can't tell what is good and what is bad. Nonetheless, life is quite marvelous. So, that's what I've gotten out of it so far, and ask me back in 5 years, and maybe I will have turned something else up. There is a tragedy in this. We are immersed in stories. As you can go home after this speech and turn the television on, and you can see 10 stories before you go to sleep. God knows how many thousands of stories we read or are told in the course of our lives. And this rise and fall I've told you is people getting into trouble and getting out of it again. This is pleasing to us. Or finding something, losing it, and getting it back. This is pleasing to us. We love that rise and fall, and we come to expect it of stories. And these curves are excellent just for storytellers. They have nothing to do with life, but we have heard so many stories that we imagine our lives should be like that too. And I'm persuaded that many marriages break up just because they don't seem to be like very good stories. As you know, the kid is all right, I like the house, the sex is okay. But it really isn't much of a story, is it? There's no rise and fall. Couldn't one of us please get into trouble and get out of it again? Couldn't we find something we really like and lose it and get it back again? And so people are deeply disappointed in their lives because they're not good stories. And I am persuaded that Ernest Hemingway was a victim of this mistake, believing life should be a story. He believed his life was a story, and he believed it was over, it should properly end when he could no longer write, no longer felt like writing, or perhaps was not a great lover anymore. And he punctuated himself, and I mean this seriously, is that shotgun shell in his shotgun was a period. And it's a very sad business, and I'm sure that there are many tragedies of that sort all the time, as people saying, God, I'm a washout, I'm not much of a story. The Indians are right and Hamlet is right. There isn't any real rise and fall. Another of my great inventions is a government issue or artificial extended family. Loneliness is a basic American disease, or was before herpes, I guess. And I think that when we left our homelands to settle in this new continent, we left our families behind, and this has cost us more than we know, left us far lonelier than most people in the world are. We do not have enough friends and relatives to support us in small matters and occasionally in large matters. As in Nigeria, for example, it's quite ordinary to have 1,000 relatives. If you have an extended family, if you have lots of relatives around you, and you have a kid who can't stand you, or you have a kid that you can't stand, is that kid can go off and move in with some relatives who are more congenial. This is what happens in areas where they have extended families, and these people can come to your support and help you in all sorts of ways, as take care of the baby for a couple of weeks while you're sick or whatever. But we're all alone, or just have a couple of associates, usually a mate. And so I want the government to remedy this immediately. And this is a social reform which will cost absolutely nothing or very little, because all the machinery is in place. As the Social Security Administration already has most of our names and addresses and has the computers. I want them to issue us artificial relatives chosen at random. Get a letter in the mail saying, from now on, you are to use the middle name Raspberry 14 or Squirrel 3 or Peanut 6 or whatever. You also get a little phone book, a little directory of all your relatives. Now, if you're a Raspberry 16, there'll be 1,000 people in this country, which is what a Nigerian gets in the way of relatives. Is why should we do any worse? All with the middle name Raspberry 16. Now, there are also raspberry 1, raspberry 2, raspberry 3, and so forth families through 20. And anybody with raspberry in his middle name is a member of your clan. Now, you are entitled to approach these people. If you are moved from San Diego to Bangor, Maine, and you have to buy property there in a hurry or rent an apartment or whatever, you can look in your directory. And by God, there are not one but two raspberry 17s in Bangor. And you can call one of them up and say, you know, how much rent should I pay? How much rent is other people, are other people paying? Or can you, I've got a toothache, can you tell me who a good dentist is? You can approach these people. We don't dare approach anybody now for fear of getting killed. I mean, you can ask for small favors. It's now, because nobody has enough relatives, because nobody has any relatives, people call the police department for everything, or occasionally, special cases, the fire department. And I don't blame the government for thinking that Americans want too many services from the government. But we do not have the extended families which ordinarily perform all these comforting social functions. And with an extended family, you can take care of lunatics often better than the government can do it. But anyway, the government would not require you to treat these new relatives of yours any better than you treat the relatives you've got now. If somebody calls up and says, hi, I'm a raspberry 17, can you lend me $15 till next Tuesday? You can just simply hang up. This is what you what you might do to your brother anyway. It just gives us an excuse to approach each other. It would take care of the race problem immediately, because these artificial families would seem like races to us, as our minds will make races out of anything. And pretty soon you will hear, you know, is the turtle 17s or a rotten bunch? And I would never have... Squirrel 3s are nice people and I like them, but never let them close to money. Why are so many daffodils gay? And you will feel closer to your as close to your artificial relatives after a couple of years go by as you would to your real ones, which might often be not close at all. Anyway, this would cost nothing. I think it would be elating to everyone. Now then, I have discovered a new disease, as though I hadn't already done enough. And I have to reason this very closely, so there'll be very little eye contact on this. And it starts out very slow, but it picks up. It really does start out terribly slow. What has America's greatest contribution to the culture of this planet been? Many people would say jazz. I will say Alcoholics Anonymous. Not funny. Alcoholics Anonymous is the first scheme to deal successfully with the tragic mysteries of addiction. Addiction not simply to alcohol, but to all sorts of chemicals which can give pleasure briefly, but which in the long term can turn the lives of addicts and those around them into hell. The Alcoholics Anonymous scheme, which will work only if an addict will admit regularly that this or that chemical is poison to him, is now proving its effectiveness with compulsive gamblers who do not swallow pleasure-giving chemicals or sniff them or inject them into their veins. Compulsive gamblers generate bad chemicals inside themselves when the cards are dealt or the dice are rattled or the wheel is spun. Compulsive gamblers have learned to be their own producers of what are for them bad, dangerous substances. At a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, a member is expected to introduce himself in this manner. My name is so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. At a meeting of Gamblers Anonymous, The member is expected to stand up and introduce himself in this manner, as I am so-and-so, and I'm a compulsive gambler. Members are encouraged to testify at meetings as to how the chemicals they swallowed or generated within themselves alienated their friends and relatives, lost them jobs and houses, deprived them of their last shreds of dignity. Not every member has sunk quite that low, of course, but many have. Many, if not most, members have done what they call hitting bottom before seeking help, before admitting what it is that's been ruining their lives for so long. I wish to call attention to another dangerous form of addiction which has not previously been identified as such. It is like compulsive gambling, since the afflicted person seeks situations which will cause his body to release certain exciting chemicals into his bloodstream. We should recognize that there are among us persons who are tragically hooked on preparations for war. Not war itself, but preparations for war. Tell them that a war is coming and that we have to get ready for it, and for a little while they are as happy as an alcoholic who has just had 3 martinis for breakfast. Let us recognize how sick these people are and stop encouraging them when they satisfy their craving. From now on, when a national leader or even just a neighbor starts talking about some new weapon system which is going to cost $11 trillion, we should speak up. We should say something on the order of, "Honest to God, I couldn't be sorrier for you if I'd watched you wash down a handful of amphetamines with a pint of Southern Comfort." I mean it. I am not joking. Compulsive preparers for World War III are as tragically, yes, and as repulsively addicted as any wino passed out in a toilet stall in the Port Authority bus terminal. For an alcoholic to experience a few moments of happiness, he needs maybe $3 worth of green alcohol. For a compulsive gambler to experience a few moments of happiness, he needs only a few dollars to risk at a table. But for a person addicted to preparations for war to experience a few moments of fleeting happiness, we may have to buy him a Trident submarine. If Western civilization, which blankets most of the world now and includes the Soviet Union, if Western civilization were a person, we should be directing that person to the nearest meeting of War Preparers Anonymous. We should be telling it to stand up before the meeting and say, "My name is Western Civilization. I am a compulsive war preparer. I have lost everything I ever cared about. I should have come here long before. I first hit bottom in World War I. I am serious. Western civilization can't be represented by a single person, but a single explanation for the disastrous course it has followed in this bloody century is possible. We, the people, have again and again mistaken for great leaders very sick persons, compulsive preparers for war. If we, the people, stop making this tragic mistake and perhaps set up treatment centers for the addicts who have ruined us, then Western civilization's long, hard trip back to permanent sobriety can begin. Appeasement. That is something the war preparers say we are never to engage in, or something terrible will happen to us. But everywhere I look, I see appeasement going on. North and South America, on both sides of the Iron Curtain. Who is being appeased? Communists? Neo-Nazis? No, it is the compulsive preparers for war. I can scarcely name a nation now which has not lost most of its freedom and wealth in trying to appease its own addicts to preparations for war. And there is no appeasing an addict for very long. Honest to God, man, just give me enough money for a few multiple reentry vehicles and a fleet of B-1... and a fleet of B-1 bombers, and I'll never bother you again. Most addictions start innocently enough in childhood, I think, under agreeable, reputable auspices. A sip of champagne at a wedding, game of poker for matchsticks on a rainy afternoon. Parents approve. Addicts of war preparation may have been encouraged when babies to clap their hands at a 4th of July parade. Not everybody gets hooked. Not every child who gets a cap gun in his Christmas stocking is going to be saying later that the only way for us to be happy and safe is to knock down incoming missiles with laser beams. Not every child who sees his father shoot quail on a crisp autumn morning is later going to tell us that we must stop squandering money on education and public health and food and shelter and clothing in order that we can protect our way of life with invincible weaponry. Please note, I am talking about an addiction to preparations for war, to parades and test firings and ship christenings and planning secret strategies and so on. I am not talking about addiction to war itself, which is a very different matter. A compulsive preparer for war no more wants to go to war than an alcoholic wants to wake up in a toilet stall in the Port Authority bus terminal. Should addicts of any sort hold high office in this or any other country? Absolutely not. The first priority of an addict is always going to be to satisfy his addiction, no matter how terrible the consequences may be, even to himself. Suppose we had an alcoholic president who still had not hit bottom and whose chief companions were drunks like himself. And suppose it were a fact made absolutely clear to him that if he took one more drink, the whole planet would blow up. So he has all the liquor thrown out of the White House, including his aftershave lotion. So late that night, he is terribly restless, crazy for a drink, but proud of not drinking. So he opens the White House refrigerator, looking for a tab or a Diet Pepsi, he tells himself. And there, half hidden behind a family-sized jar of French's mustard, is an unopened can of Budweiser. What do you think he'll do? That's the end of my speech.